So let's turn our attention to the question of unemployment in the country and the role that the labor laws of this country actually play when it comes to addressing the unemployment issue. Etsy Brovic is the director at Malcolm Lyons and Brovic. Good morning and thank you so much for your time, see?
Good morning, Kathy, and to your listener, and thank you for hosting me.
It's a contentious conversation depending on who you are speaking to, because oftentimes when we look at labor laws, they're not just there for the fun of it. They're there because we do have industry players that come in and want to take advantage of people and exploit people's rights. So those labor laws are there to offer some level of protection to workers in various sectors. When you look at the question of unemployment, you point to the labor laws, restrictive labor laws, as perhaps being a hindrance to stimulating employment in the country. Why?
So thank you, Kathy. What prompted me to have a look at it and to reassess it yet again, and I have considered this question in the past, was this terrible level of violence and rioting that we saw 6 or 7 weeks ago, the worst we've seen since our constitution and our democracy. And much of it has been attributed to poverty. But what is poverty in essence? It is unemployment and lack of opportunity. And I was wondering yet again how our labor laws, which are so developed, and we must congratulate NEDLAC, et cetera, on the work that they did in 94 and going forward with drafting the labor relations legislation. Because at that time, what they were faced was this huge level of unfairness in bargaining power, which existed between employers and employees in the workplace. Unions, although they were authorized and allowed at the time, had very limited negotiating power. And that was all about to change. And it was a change at the time for the better, because it allowed employees within the workplace to even up the negotiation table. In other words, they could then say, this is unfair. My hours are too long. My wages are too low. My working conditions are too poor. And how can we rectify this? And now they had the means with which to do that and the backing of our law underpinned by the Constitution. But what's happened over time is that there's been this push and pull, this tension between those who are in employment, those who have those benefits, and those who want to be employed, those who are currently unemployed or underemployed, which means they're not employed to their full capacity or to the extent of their skill or want. And what it's created is this protectionism which exists between those who are employed and represented by unions with a huge level of bargaining power which they have and which is entrenched, against those who would like to come into work. Where it reveals itself, for instance, is where those who are employed push wages and salaries up to the extent that they exclude new employees from coming on board. In other words, the wages are preventative. So that's one aspect. But what we're really looking at is the ease with which people can become employed and with which they can lose employment, because both are important. Because what the laws at the moment have created is they've created a mess of cost and time consumption at both ends of that relationship. So when you take somebody on, you have to follow certain procedures. You have to ensure that you protect those employees, which is all justifiable. You've got to protect employees from discrimination. You've got to prevent them from not being eligible for jobs for reasons which are unconstitutional. But at the same time, you want to be sure that taking on employees by an employer is made relatively frictionless and easy. On the other end, and this is probably the one which most employers would face, is the termination of those employments. When those employments come to an end, how does that happen? What is the level of expense and time consumption that's involved in that? And that's where I'm suggesting as well that the Labor Relations Act and the case law and practice that has developed over the past 20-odd years have made it almost made it a formidable exercise for employers, particularly small and medium employers, to undertake. And I say that because there are processes in place, again, necessary, because we do have a provision in our law that provide that an employee's version of events must be heard if it's a dismissal for misconduct, or be allowed to present evidence on performance or capacity if those are the issues. So those are all important. But what's happened is it's created this level of tension where employers are less likely to take on employees because they're thinking, what happens if I don't need this person in a number of months' time? What happens if my my employment situation changes, the business environment changes, as we've seen over the last 18 months, particularly with COVID-19, how then and at what cost will I be able to rectify or restabilize my ship, my company, by bringing my employment levels down again? And it's those aspects that perhaps we could look at. Ironically, when the Labor Relations Act was first published, the processes weren't as defined as they have subsequently become by case law, to the extent of process and substance, etc., to allow for small and medium operators to take on employment and also shed employees as and when it's required. But over time, the processes have solidified, become more concrete, and through mechanisms such as referrals to the CCMA, etc., an employee who doesn't follow this process can face a substantial award, compensatory award against him.
We're in conversation with Tsi Brevik. He is a director at Malkin Loynes and Brevik, and we're reflecting then on the role of the country's labor laws when it comes to employment and, of course, directly or indirectly then unemployment. As a small business or as a medium business, how do you go about procuring the services that you need? What are the kinds of conversations that you are having with your employees, especially where you are unable to guarantee long-term employment, but you definitely need people on? And after the break, we'll find out from Z how he believes the current labor laws, what is the solution then to the problem that he has put on the table? Yes, the labor laws are there to protect workers, but in the absence of those laws being relaxed, what are the solutions that we can look at on the table to ensure that employment is not being stifled on the other end of the scope? I'm going to take a quick break and we'll continue our conversation after this. Thimo Hlahlana on SAFM. You're live on The Talking Point. We are looking at how else the employment in this country can be stimulated, particularly through the lens of, adjusting labor laws. So, see, what is the solution? Is the answer to then do away with the labor laws, the restrictive labor laws, as you've described them?
We cannot disregard our history and the growth and equality in the labor law environment which existed prior to our constitution and the Labor Relations Act. So certainly I'm not advocating, as I've said in my article, to say to hell with protective labor laws and let's disassemble everything that we've constructed over the last 27 years. That's not the suggestion. We're not moving to a system which is akin to the one in the United States, where you can simply arrive in the morning and find that you've been pink slipped and that you've lost your work, where you haven't had an opportunity to make any representation. What I am suggesting is that we firstly make our labor law requirements easier for employers to navigate. By that I mean we try and streamline the processes, try and make it so that compliance with the labor laws is far simpler for employers. At the moment, an employer or a small, particularly in a small, medium-sized enterprise, would have to have quite a high level or a degree of knowledge of labor laws in order to ensure that any dismissal is both procedurally and substantively fair. They would have to know that both those elements in the first place are required and compulsory, and then how to go about doing that. And if you take into account who manages and runs the small, medium enterprises, these are persons who are normally, typically, perhaps 5 to 10 persons, and medium-sized enterprises, obviously a little bit larger. They're focused on growing their business, client satisfaction, getting product. I mean, there are lots of issues and aspects which they're considering on a daily basis. Labor law is not going to be one of them. It's become a specialized field of practice. It's become a specialized field of knowledge. And so you'd want to make it more accessible. So that's the first thing. And the way to do that is to perhaps take the body of law that we've got at the moment and distill it. Distill it in a way that it's comprehensible, understandable, it's written in plain language and not in legalese, so that somebody who's managing their business doesn't have to take either the time or the resources, cash resources, out of a growing business to comply. That's the first suggestion. The second would be to see how we can satisfy or quell the tension which exists between unions. We are protecting employees already employed and those employed and the unemployed. And why I suggest that is because a great barrier to employment is experience. And the only way to get experience as an employee is to become employed. But if employers are reluctant to take a person on because they're an unknown quantity, they're fresh out of school, hopefully and they haven't had any previous experience, or they've been looking at this, as is sadly and tragically the case in for many job seekers in our economy, is that they've been out of school for 2 or 3 years and have been seeking employment. The longer they are out of work, the less appealing they are to prospective employers, the harder it is for them to become employees and gain that experience. So you want to get them in somehow. So you want to be sure that, that there is a mechanism to do that. There are various government work programs, such as the community work program, certain student allocations which the government has made to encourage that. But I believe that it's also the laws that, that act as a restraining factor to that employment taking place. So we look to see how we can lessen that tension by providing some gap for these new job seekers to get into the job market. And the third is, and perhaps the more contentious, is we look at the laws containing employment equity legislation and the plans that are provided, because very often they exclude persons who are disadvantaged but may not necessarily be considered to be previously disadvantaged within that economy or within that geographical area. And so positions remain unoccupied or vacated to the exclusion or disadvantage of persons who would normally fall within that, that very legislation which seeks to protect them. So those are three suggestions or solutions which I've put on the table for consideration.
You know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about the conversations sometimes that happen, and it comes down to this question of compliance and why compliance seems to be so difficult. Because often what it results in is that you have then a lot of informal employment that is taking place, which also becomes quite risky for the person that's taking on a job. So because it's so difficult for me as a small business to comply with what the labor law requires, we just have informal conversations with somebody and, you know, they are paid wages and everything kind of happens under the radar.
That's an excellent point. And the difficulty with that is that circumvents the labor laws completely. So any protection offered, no matter how little, is then avoided. But it also means that that prospective employee is not registered for UIF. There's no workman's compensation. All the other occupational health and safety within the workplace is bypassed. So all the measures which the government has put in place to protect employees are completely swept aside. And it's so avoiding the labor law comes at great cost to the employee, not so much to the employer. Of course, to the employer, as you say, it's a question of compliance and maybe ultimately a fine if somebody goes out and inspects the business and they don't comply with any compliance orders they're given. But for the employee, the prospective downside is massive.
Let me take a call from Solomon. You're calling us from Limpopo. Good morning, Solomon.
Hey, good morning, Kathy. How are you, Kathy?
I'm well, thank you.
Kathy, wishes you the best with your the person who is representing maybe a labourer. All right, let me go to the elephant. I would be very much happy to get the cell phone of the rep there. I will chat with him. I will show him what we are doing. We could create a lot of jobs to what we are doing. Let me go to the elephant matter. We are doing the job of the toilet, to build the toilet, that flushing, running water without any storage. That is what we are doing. We are putting the curtains, we are putting the mirror. It will be so beautiful. Even you, Kathy, you could send, because I gave the representative maybe my phone number there. Now, this, the one who is talking about, we are training the people. 90% of youth, tomorrow, Friday, I should have been with a representative of the Department of Education called Martin. And he told me that he will never come, maybe he will come next week. We have to chat on Monday. Remember, I've been in his office from September 2020 up to now. These people, they're not serious about the people who are not working. You know, my heart is burning because youth who are not working, and we are training them, and they should be working. We have gotten a three items. It's why this you are red. I want his cell phone. I will send him the toilet so that he could see. And other things, the tiles, it's a three tiles which we're training. It's a plate.
So Solomon, what do you need from the education department?
No, they have to come, you know, they say they want to inspect that so that we could proceed with the matter.
Mm.
And we agreed, we sent an email, they acknowledged the what you call, what do we call it, the letter. But end up today in the morning, and he said he will never come. And we were already told if he doesn't come, he should send somebody. There are many people. Mm. If the president is not here, let somebody come. You know these people of Limpopo, they paid $2 million by Section 27, the child who fall in the pity.
Mm.
And now there is a place, Khashane and Muleji. I heard them in a broadcast crying that they are taking them to the High Court. But why they are not coming to this student which we are training them so that we finish this matter of toilet? Let me finish by this one. Liura, I cannot blame him. He's a manager. He says to me, we have to train also 4 members of each school of SGB. These things is talking and talking and talking. Why we are not putting things in practical?
All right.
I want to talk. If you could, Kathy, let me finish by this one, Kathy. Please. Arrange me to talk to the premier because there is another issue which I will show him. That could create a job also.
Okay, and Solomon, we're going to have to leave it there. Solomon out in Limpopo. But I think he's made the point that they have a training program. They've been told it needs to be inspected, but that has not taken place. It's 11:30. Let me go to the latest headlines with Luyanda.
The Talking Point with Kathy Motlhatlhana. Weekdays, 9 a.m. till midday.
All right, thanks for staying with the conversation on the Talking Point. I guess, Solomon, the issue that Solomon was raising is again about how then restrictive some of the compliance matters can be. Because with a project like theirs, they've been waiting for the official since September, he said, to come and do the necessary checks and balances. But that has not been done, and that obviously has an impact on what they can and can't do.
Yeah, sadly, Kathy, we have heard the story before, and government is not exempt from this conduct, where job seekers are so desperate for work. I'm sure you've seen news reports where at times 2,000 people may show up from queuing from early in the morning in respect of an application for 5 or 10 jobs, or that just there's no prospect of them getting. But where they've been training on the job, actually doing the work, but then the work isn't recognized. And so it's not paid for work. And the underlying promise that there will be gainful employment doesn't materialize. So that is frustrating. And in effect, even though they're working for the Limpopo government or municipality, they're still actually working, as you had said prior to the news, they're working unofficially, without recognition, in a grey market with no protection.
Mm.
And it's a terrible position to be in, particularly if you've committed since September of last year.
Let me take one voice note for you, Tsi. It's a question that somebody would like some advice on.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you for hosting this conversation about the labor law. There is a question that I have. I actually resigned from a position earlier this year from the company that I was doing sales for. Reason being, I wasn't too happy about the way I was treated and spoken to, and there were some discrepancies with a commission as well that was owed to me. I did join another company who was considered to be a bit of a competitor to the company that I was with, but because I signed a contract which had a restraint of trade, which was for 5 years and anywhere in the country, my previous company threatened to take me up on that. So I did a bit of research, and you know, there's not much online. It's a bit vague. as to what protection we have, because of course I've been a sales rep for a long time. It's the only job that I know that I'm comfortable with, as well as it's the only job that I can actually get at the moment. And jobs are tough to come by, and I've got expenses to meet as well. What protection is there for someone in my situation?
Kathy?
Yes. Do you have some advice for him?
Certainly, I've got advice. I mean, it's a complex question. We're talking about issues of resignation. We're talking about a type of dismissal, which is referred to as a constructive dismissal, where an employee tenders their resignation against their will. In other words, when the employer makes continued employment intolerable. And then I think what the caller is really asking for is, what can you do about the restraint of trade to which he's a signatory? So it's a contract between the employer and the employee. And that contract, it doesn't sit within labor law. It's a question of interpretation. And in order to do that, we would have to look at the position which he held, to what extent he was aware of the trade secrets, knowledge, know-how of his former employer, and the position that he's gone into. Is it in the same geographical area? Is it selling the same or similar product, using the same skill? But the tension there, the constitutional tension, which exists between his freedom or right to make a living, and also the sanctity of a contract. In other words, he's bound himself willingly to a contract, which now he seeks to extricate himself from. So this is a little bit more complex and somewhat out of our the ambit of this conversation. So I don't know if we have the time for it, but certainly I'd be more than willing to assist.
Okay, great. So maybe what we can do is that we can put you in touch with him after the show, and maybe you'll be able to assist him further offline. All right, one last voice note for you, see?
Thank you.
Hi, Kathy. And SFM listeners, is over in Northern Cape. I want to ask your guest there about the labor laws and so on. I'm working for a company for about 5 years now. We only deducted that is UIF as well as the pay as you earn, known as PAYE. So if I'm to leave or to resign today, am I entitled to any benefits there, or is just nothing for me? Like I'm resigning or I'm just leaving. Are there any benefits which I will get from the company after saving for so long, because we don't have provident fund or anything deducted from us? Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. So it sounds as if the only deductions which are made from the salary are PAYE and UIF. One is a tax. So it's a tax which we all pay on our earnings, which is payable to the receiver. And that's, of course, calculated on the sliding scale. The other is UIF. It's an unemployment insurance fund benefit, which is deducted from each of the employee, calculated as a percentage of the income. And that's really social security to assist an employee should they lose employment. Unfortunately, with a resignation, that UIF wouldn't be actionable. They wouldn't be able to call on it. Very different to if there was a dismissal which took place, or if there was a maternity benefit, for example, in which case the UIF fund would be able to make some payments. Of course, TERS, which was put into place immediately after the hard lockdown, was an extension of UIF to assist employees who were remaining at home as a result of COVID-19. But sadly, without contribution to a provident or pension fund, mostly a provident fund nowadays, there's no benefit which you would be able to take away should you step away from his position now.
All right. See, Brivik, let me thank you so much for your time on the show today, and also for taking some of those questions from our listeners. He is the director at Malcolm Loins and Brivik. So, yeah, we're going to leave it there for now in terms of that conversation. After the break, we change gears slightly, not too far off, however, still within the sector of labor. But we're talking this time about BBBEE.